And yes, Wellington, we are undergoing a fairly dense earthquake at the moment. So please just get to somewhere where you are safely under some protection.
10 seconds that felt like an eternity. That was all it took.
I thought I was going to die.
As the violent and unforgiving February earthquake brought buildings across Christchurch to their knees.
In New Zealand, there is a lot of damage after that magnitude 7.8 earthquake, but there's also a strong sense of relief because it could have been so much worse.
The big problem is that the town of Kaikoura is cut off.
This is the price of living on a fault line. And here's another cost. Earthquake strengthening rules for buildings in the firing line.
We cannot completely remove these risks, but we need to do what is practically possible to improve public safety.
But when the cost of doing that becomes overwhelming, how do we balance safety with risk?
Apartment owners in Wellington are pleading for an urgent review of the ruin they say they're facing under earthquake strengthening rules.
It's the first thing you think of in the morning, the last thing you think of when you go to bed at night, and quite often the things you're thinking about when you wake up sweating in the middle of it.
Keeping people safe from harm when disasters strike is important, but if how we do that is by ruining the lives of more people than will be saved, then we must think again.
A Southland town fears for the future of its main street as owners ditch their buildings rather than have them strengthened for earthquakes. This is all prompting calls for the government to reconsider the rules around this.
Now, the government has hit pause while that happens.
Owners of earthquake-prone buildings will now have a four-year extension on the deadline to strengthen or demolish. In a widely anticipated move last week, the government also announced it would bring forward a review of earthquake legislation. That will begin immediately.
The move has been met with both praise.
Huge cost escalations with construction, inflation, all of that stuff. So it's making it near impossible for a lot of owners to upgrade their buildings. So providing them with a bit more time and potentially a solution, I think is hugely positive.
And fear.
A lot of texters this morning, I have to say, texting in saying, look, lives are at risk here. A lot of people from Christchurch texting in saying, this will put lives at risk.
Kia ora, I'm Tom Kitchen, and today on The Detail, the government's delay to bring earthquake-prone buildings up to standard and its review of the law. Is this the rescue building owners need, or will such a lifeline lead to more disaster? Piers Fuller is a senior reporter for The Post, based in Masterton. He's been covering earthquake-prone building issues for several years. We start by talking about the new rules put in place after the Christchurch and Kaikoura earthquakes, officially the Earthquake-Prone Buildings Amendment Act.
It came into force in 2017. That had goals of making buildings safer and saving lives. And obviously the government had learned a lot from Christchurch and also Kaikoura. They brought clarity around identifying earthquake-prone buildings, about the council's obligations and how they would get the owners to enforce their responsibilities around remediating those buildings, and also gave them timeframes to work to. And the timeframes were set on the risk levels that different parts of the country had. So if you were in high-risk areas, which does cover a lot of the country, you had effectively half the time that you may have in lower-risk areas.
Yeah, so where were some of these high-risk, medium-risk, low-risk areas?
So high-risk pretty much covers the east of the North Island, the east of the top end of the South Island, down to Canterbury or mid-Canterbury, and also the west coast, most of the west coast of the South Island as well. You're looking at Christchurch, Blenheim, Wellington, the whole east coast, that's just Hastings, Gisborne, Napier, obviously, famous for its earthquakes.
On the morning of February the 3rd, 1931, at 10:48, the district was shaken by an earthquake of the magnitude of 7.75 on the Richter scale, the epicentre being 20 kilometres northwest of Napier.
Then you've got the medium risk zone, which goes through the mid-North Island and through parts of sort of Canterbury and Otago, and then the low risk, which is the coastal Otago, Dunedin, and from Auckland up northward to throughout the whole of Northland.
Also in that legislation in 2017, there was a national register of earthquake-prone buildings put in place?
Yes, and that national register is a great resource for keeping tabs on where all these buildings are. You can either go and have a look at a map and it'll show you all the little dots of all the buildings in and you look at a city like Wellington, it's just absolutely covered in them. And then you can go and have a look at the notices that have been issued and when they're due. So it's creating the crisis that Wellington is in now is because you've got, I hate to use that term, but it's kind of a tsunami of deadlines that are coming up over the next 3 or 4 years. By the end of 2027, there's going to be almost 300 buildings in Wellington that have to be dealt with. And most of them take quite a high level of intervention. They're not easy. Most of the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, buildings that are easy to fix, have already been done. So with 300 buildings and owners, many owners, quite reticent to actually to do the work, then you can imagine the obligations on a council to get those done and potential lawsuits, potential interventions is going to be really high. And among its own estimates, Wellington City Council thinks that it will only have 20% of those buildings done in that time frame.
So 20%?
20%. And it's a real crunch point. You know, they won't be able to do it. The owners won't be able to fix them. And you're going to have all these people, all these owners, all these companies and councils in breach of the legislation.
What exact standards do they have to meet by this deadline, these 300 buildings in Wellington you talk about?
So you've got the NBS, the new building standard, that's attached to a rating. So if a building is identified by the council as being potentially earthquake prone, then that building will need to get an assessment by an engineer. That engineering assessment will come up with a percentage on the new building standard with the NBS. And that NBS is a critical assessment standard. And if it's below 34% of the NBS, new building standard, it will be designated as earthquake prone. And then it has to be fixed or demolished. And around that is if it's a heritage building, it can't be demolished without a specific resource consent.
For an expert's view on this, we're going to Nick Brook, President of the Structural Engineering Society of New Zealand.
New Zealand's obviously got a very large stock of existing buildings. Over time, our understanding of earthquakes and what a building needs to do to resist those has grown and changed. In particular, over the last 40 or 50 years, there's really been some quite dramatic advances. And so you can broadly say that older buildings, on average, are not as good as the buildings we're putting up today. And so the rules on earthquake-prone buildings are part of the Building Act, which have a view to making sure that existing buildings are safe enough overall to not pose too much of a risk to people during earthquakes. The 2017 changes filled in a lot of the gaps and tightened things up.
So those rules obviously came in because we had two very serious earthquakes.
That's right. The earthquakes and the Royal Commission that followed them certainly revealed some confusions that existed in the existing rules. The 2017 changes essentially put in place a methodology that MBIE set, saying that engineers should use this specific set of rules when they're looking at existing buildings. It's not solved the problem perfectly, but it at least means everyone's got a reasonably common starting point.
And there was a whole talk about the new building standard, right, and it having to be up to 34%. What does that all mean?
Yeah, correct. So we in New Zealand for new buildings have a building code, and that by and large calls up a variety of documents that set the standard that's required for a new building. Everyone recognises that it's unrealistic to expect all existing buildings to be brought right up to that standard. The Building Act says that for existing buildings, the minimum target standard is one third of what's required for a new building. And that then flows through that if a building has less than that strength when an engineer considers how it's put together and how it's configured and how big and tall it is and how heavy, if they find that the capacity is less than one third of what would be required for the same building on the same site if it was put there new, then that gets described as what's a potentially earthquake-prone building.
But despite everyone operating from the same rulebook, a lot of problems arose. Back to Piers Fuller.
I've been dealing with some owners of a building in Wellington on Egmont Street. It's a heritage building called the Tea Store. It's a lovely building. Look, from the outside, it was refurbished with 19 apartments in 1999 to the code back then. I mean, it's a modern building on the inside. It's got beautiful apartments and it's got a lot of strengthening. You can see the steel strengthening throughout the building, and it's a lovely place to live. But subsequent engineering assessments have put it below the code, below the 34% of the NBS, and therefore it has to be fixed. You've got a situation where these owners own quite a high-end apartment, which would have been valued possibly $1 million these days. Now that value has almost been completely destroyed, possibly even comes with a liability because you can't knock the building down because it's got heritage listing. So they are in a building that stood up really well in the Kaikoura earthquakes. Pretty much no damage, as I understand, and they're perfectly happy to live there, yet they are now in breach of the law. It puts them in this almost intractable situation. They're occupying it basically in breach of the law, and they want the council to tell them what to do from here. Imagine you're an owner of one of those apartments and most of your wealth was tied up in your apartment, and you suddenly find that not only that wealth for your retirement, whatever, could be wiped out, but you don't know if you're criminally responsible for just living there. And one of the residents is one of New Zealand's most famous architects. His name's Roger Walker. You know, he understands construction and how to build a safe home, and he's more than happy to live in there in perpetuity, which comes back to the thing, where do you place the risk? Because it's all about saving people's lives and preventing unnecessary deaths. But should people be allowed to carry risk if it's their own home and it's their own apartment and accept a small amount of risk? Because that's essentially what it is. There's a building in Masterton called the Public Trust Building. It's privately owned. It was decided by the government in the 1940s during the war that it was the best place to store the Treaty of Waitangi outside of Wellington in case of attack. So it was put in this building, I think it was for a couple of decades. Now that building, which was deemed to be the strongest, safest place in New Zealand at the time, is now earthquake prone. And that owner will have to fix that. And these buildings also went through a prominent earthquake in 1941 in Wairarapa, which did a lot of damage and a lot of buildings were destroyed. This building stood up fine. So I guess this all comes back to the NBS rating. And is it capturing too many buildings? Some buildings which are pretty sturdy and safe to live in and to work in, are they being captured by these low engineering assessments? So that's one. Another big effect on Masterton is the town hall was deemed earthquake prone. It's been empty for about 5 years. There were replacement estimates for a new one went up to $70 million. You can imagine the Masterton ratepayers not wanting to pay $70 million for a new town hall, a new civic centre. That's what you get in these small towns. Masterton has 92 buildings which are earthquake prone, which is a lot for a small territorial authority to have to deal with that many owners. And a lot of those buildings are a single story. They're not big buildings that are going to collapse. They're small private buildings. If you look at Ashburton, they've got a raft of buildings that are now past their deadline. But every town, every small town is going to have it.
Nick Brooks found some problems too.
There's been a lot of news stories over the last year or two or three about buildings, particularly in Wellington, being vacated because they don't achieve a certain earthquake standard. And that being below the expectation of tenants, building occupiers and so forth. That tends to be driven more by market expectations rather than by what's actually in the Building Act.
What do you mean?
So the idea of percent MBS that's been adopted by the property market and tenants and building owners and so forth as a another means of distinguishing good buildings from better buildings, or better buildings from good buildings, and so on and so forth. And so where the legal minimum is this 34% number, a lot of occupiers of buildings, corporate tenants and so forth, now require much higher standards than that. So maybe 67% of the new building standard, or 80% even, is a common number these days.
The government's own institutions have famously been caught up in these risk assessments.
The Ministry of Education's head office in Bowen Street in Wellington was closed yesterday after it was revealed it met only 25% of the criteria under the new guidelines for seismic assessment. Well, back now to our lead story, the shock announcement that Hutt Hospital's main building is an earthquake risk and must close. We understand its earthquake rating is just 15% of the new building standard.
I did another story with another apartment building in Wellington, and Hazel Kirkham is a bit of a apartment seismic crusader. She went through MBIE's cost-benefit analysis and the chances of buildings falling down and the amount of people that would be killed. And she worked out that to save one life, there had to be $1.8 billion worth of investment, and that's private investment by owners. And so, for example, take their building. If you, apartment buildings in Wellington, when they first rolled out this legislation, it was estimated that it might cost $30,000 for per apartment to bring your building up to standard. Now that figure is somewhere around $400,000, estimated by advocacy group in a city, Wellington, $400,000. And some apartments, it could be up to $1 million. So for those people who are occupying those apartments, it's turned a great option for inner city living into a terrible option, because it may wipe out any wealth that they have, and it's a very stressful situation that they're now in. The 2016 Act, which came into force in 2017, the estimate by the government was that it was going to cost the country $750 million. The liabilities on Wellington City Council alone, just the council, this is not private liabilities, will be probably more than that. So you can imagine, if you calculated the actual liabilities of this legislation across the country and you take in Auckland City's 1,500 buildings, you're talking billions and billions and billions of dollars. So I think that's where it's all got out of kilter. It's yes, we want to save lives, but at what cost? And that, I think, is why the Building and Construction Minister, Chris Penk, is taking this seriously, and he has listened to a lot of stakeholders, particularly in our region, but I'm sure around the rest of the country as well.
We need the settings to be right to actually enable people to do the work, because there's no point government sitting at Wellington and saying that work must be done as a matter of legal compliance if it's not practical and not actually getting done.
This extension needs to happen. The buildings won't be fixed in time, and they need to change the way that the law is executed so that fewer buildings get caught up in it.
There was also so much talk about people wanting this law to change for years and years, but the previous government didn't do anything?
I think there was a lot of inaction by previous governments. I'm told by the likes of Wellington City Councillor Iona Pannett, who has been quite rigorous with seismic issues. She said that having this decision by the current government was the most positive step forward in several years, because previous governments have done very little.
So can we just talk about now the risks with bringing this review forward? So a lot of people say it's a really positive step. But, I mean, if we get an earthquake in the next few years, there might be calls for, why was this delayed?
Yeah, exactly. And that's always been the case. But the fact is that earthquake strengthening, even before the 2016 legislation, has been earthquake strengthening rules for decades. And it's been pushed down the road again and again and again. And if you keep doing that, then sooner or later there will be a big earthquake which will kill people in weak buildings. So, I mean, I think people are aware of that. If you have a four-year extension now, that four-year period, there could be a massive earthquake. So there is a risk there. And I think the justification of the risk is that the legislation needs to be reworked to be more workable for those owners.
Piers, what if we get, you know, worse buildings that won't cope as well in quakes? There's going to be less red tape, so less regulation on them. And that could have an effect if this review means it's going to be watered down.
Yeah, and that's what the government's got to do. That's the tricky line that the government's got to walk down and MBIE has got to work out. How can you change these engineering requirements so that the buildings are as safe as they possibly can be in an economic way?
Back to Nick Brook. What does he think of the government's review and extension?
Broadly speaking, they are necessary. I think a key driver is that probably there's been a lot of feedback, probably formal and informal, and just the noise in the news stories and so forth that suggests that there are aspects of the current system, whether it be the legal minimum, which probably affects smaller town New Zealand more. Whereas in the bigger cities, I think a lot of the issues that have arisen are driven more by this expectation of tenants for a higher standard.
You're pretty positive about this review happening, but there are still risks there, aren't there? I mean, if we delay doing these buildings up, if there's a quake, you know, we've lost it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Any delay does nominally increase the risk for a particular building. And so if you take a particular building and strengthen it tomorrow, then you've reduced the risk for that building compared to not doing that or doing it 5 years down the track. The aim would be that buildings keep getting strengthened. And I think naturally that will happen because someone's trying to attract new tenants and needs to bring a building to a certain standard. And so there will continue to be buildings being assessed and being strengthened. But with the stick of the punitive deadline extended out, because they can't all be done within the timeframes currently put there.
Yeah, well, some people are talking about this just rewarding procrastination.
Yeah, I can see that perspective. I guess the counterpoint to that is that a lot of buildings have been strengthened in conjunction with other works being done and probably bringing in better return for the owners and so forth now. You know, it's not a case that doing the work doesn't bring any rewards, because maybe that's what you need to do to actually have the building occupied and providing a return.
But yeah, if we have a quake before this and, you know, people die, I mean, whose fault is it that these delays were put in place?
It'd be a concerning situation to me if there was a consideration after a quake the delay had actually led to these problems. You know, it's possible in some instances that you could say, well, but for that delay, that building may have been strengthened. But we, I guess, accept that sort of thing in a lot of walks of life, a lot of aspects of life. And so the cost and expense of strengthening buildings needs to be weighed, in my mind, against all sorts of other things that we're juggling in the country. And an obvious comparator to me is always road safety. And you know, do you spend the same dollar to improve a building or do you spend it to improve the roads? Where do the risks lie? And the actual risk posed to people in buildings, even earthquake-prone buildings, is relatively low in comparison to other risks that we accept day to day. Earthquakes will happen. And unfortunately, there will probably be a number of casualties. The aim over time is to remove the worst of the worst and gradually improve things.
That's it for today. The Detail is supported by RNZ and New Zealand On Air. This episode was engineered by William Saunders and produced by Alexia Russell. Thanks to Piers Fuller and Nick Brook. I'm Tom Kitchen. Ka kite anō.